This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, January 22nd, 2014. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Thomas. Ozarks at Large is sponsored in part by the University of Arkansas's Women's Giving Circle, whose mission is to transform and expand women's giving to university programs through a collective voice.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, a conversation with author An Na. She will be speaking on the University of Arkansas campus tomorrow. Plus, in the latest installment of our monthly Spaces series, we go behind the scenes at KNWA.
We'll also pay a visit to a tree farm in Springdale and more. But first, while the Arkansas Department of Human Services says its budget plan projects savings because of the private option, the department does not have a backup in case funding for the state's Medicaid expansion plan is rejected by the legislature. In advance of next month's fiscal session, the Joint Budget Committee met yesterday. Jonathan Gober of the Bureau of Legislative Research testified that in areas such as mental health services, the DHS is projected to save money with the private option. That drew questions from Democratic Senator Linda Chesterfield.
You alluded to the fact that there were some savings that were directly related to the Affordable Care Act. Did I misunderstand that?
That is true. There is an estimated overall savings for fiscal year 15, I believe, of $89 million, and this is one of the divisions and appropriations that there is estimated savings of approximately $7.1 million.
Chesterfield went on to say funding for the private option was on life support because of the political climate in the state. Republican Representative Charlotte Douglas asked DHS Director John Selig about the accuracy of Division of Behavioral Health savings projections.
So when you're giving these projections, you're just saying we feel like we're going to save by 50%.
Yes, ma'am. We try to project conservatively. Mm-hmm. So our belief is that it will be more than that, but we felt like, to be on the safe side, that we shouldn't take more than half of the indigent care funds back at this point.
But you're not looking at real numbers.
We will at some point. We just don't have them yet.
Selig said the Division of Behavioral Health normally operates with a $14 million budget, half of which will be funded federally through the private option legislation.
While state legislators decide on whether to continue the private option, a new poll of more than 500 likely Arkansas voters shows that nearly half of those surveyed believe the private option should continue. The survey was conducted by Talk Business Arkansas and Hendricks College. 32% of those polled said the private option should end, but as Jay Barth, a political science professor at Hendricks, noted, 20% of survey respondents said they don't know whether the program should continue or be terminated.
Republican voters are actually a little more likely to say that they don't know, and I think that reflects the division that we've seen in the Republican Party leadership on this issue, is that Democrats have been very united on this issue from the beginning, but Republicans have been a little more conflicted, and that shows in the survey.
Republican lawmakers crafted the private option last year, but it only narrowly passed. The program is expected to face a tougher fight this year for its continued funding.
In a few months, Crawford County voters will be asked to decide on a sales tax increase that would provide funding for a new county jail. At its meeting earlier this week, the Crawford County Quorum Court agreed to pursue a 0.5% increase to the county sales tax. That increase would entail a 0.25-cent sales tax hike to pay for construction of the jail, as well as a 0.25-cent increase that would pay for operations of the facility once it's built. County Judge John Hall says the county is in dire need of a new facility to house detainees.
Our jail is 25 years old. It's outdated. We've had some problems with even being certified with the state, and we've also run out of room, and it's overcrowded. It's got lots of problems, and we're just going to go build a new one and try to and make it three times as large, and it'll meet all the state standards, and it'll be certified, and we will be able to handle our own people here in the county. Right now, we've got a great big portion of them in other people's jails.
And that includes some detainees being held in the Washington County Detention Center. Though county voters have thrice rejected similar proposed sales tax increases, Hall is encouraged by the recent success of a similar sales tax vote in Yell County.
We're doing something a little different. We're going to put this thing on the primary election ballot, which will let everybody that comes to vote in the primary election will have an opportunity to vote for or against this thing. So this is not going to be a special election where just a certain, the beginners come out or the four people come out. This is going to be on a general election ballot where you will have thousands of people will come to vote, and when they're voting, they'll also be voting on this issue. So it's a little different approach, and we're going to see what happens.
The Quorum Court will formally approve the sales tax issue next month. The primary election and vote on the sales tax issue will be held Tuesday, May 20th. The county currently levies a 1% sales tax, which has been in effect for more than a decade.
Arkansas Attorney General Dustin McDaniel yesterday announced that a Massachusetts real estate company is being ordered to pay reparations to the Arkansas Public Employee Retirement System. Pulaski County Circuit Judge Tim Fox granted the Attorney General's default judgment against National Timber Partners, LLC, for breach of contract. Judge Fox found that the company failed to meet its financial obligation to the retirement system as required in an October 2012 contract in which the real estate concern pledged to buy the retirement system's interest in an investment fund for $110 million. Fox ordered National Timber Partners to repay the remaining amount due to the retirement system at the time that the breach of contract occurred, or $16.5 million, plus more than $500,000 in pre-judgment interest.
A longtime former faculty member at the U of A in Fayetteville has died. Walter Lee Brown, professor emeritus of history and editor of the Arkansas Historical Quarterly, died Friday in Fayetteville. Brown was a member of this history faculty in the Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences from 1954 to 1990, and he served as editor of the Arkansas Historical Quarterly from 1958 to 1990. Brown also authored the definitive biography of Albert Pike, and in the spring of 2009, the U of A dedicated the Walter L. Brown Foyer in Old Main. He was 89 years old.
Mostly clear tonight with lows from 9 degrees with a wind chill as low as 7 degrees below zero in northwest Arkansas, and a low of 19 with a wind chill as low as 7 degrees in the Arkansas River Valley. Mostly sunny tomorrow with a high of 20 and a wind chill as low as negative 8 degrees in northwest Arkansas, and a high of 27 with a wind chill as low as 6 degrees in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow night, expect mostly clear skies with light variable winds and lows from 4 in northwest Arkansas to 11 in the Arkansas River Valley.
The specter of horse slaughter in the United States made headline news last week when Congress declined funding to USDA inspections for horse meatpacking plants. The commercial killing of horses for food ended in the United States 6 years ago, but was revived in 2011. Three horse slaughterhouses were set to open in the U.S., including one 4 hours north of us in Missouri. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports.
You have reached Range Natural Meat. And at the present time, our business is closed for all custom beef import processing. Thank you for your past patronage.
The answering machine for Rains Natural Meats, the family-run meat packer based in Gallatin, Missouri, was preparing to slaughter as many as 30 horses per week. Owner David Rains last autumn expressing a conservative view of the practice, here talking to Kansas City NBC affiliate KSHB.
You've got extremely high-quality protein, meat protein, that the world's starving for that can help feed hungry people out of these animals that are going to be destroyed anyway. What's wrong with that?
Domestic horse slaughter was once again reined in January 16th when Congress blocked it with passage of a federal omnibus spending bill, which reinstated the ban on horse meat packing facilities USDA inspections. The decision will save taxpayers a reported $5 million annually. And for the Humane Society of the United States, which has battled in favor of horses for years, it was a major victory, says Wayne Pacelli, president and CEO.
This effectively ends the efforts by some slaughterhouse operators in New Mexico, Iowa, and Missouri to start up new slaughter plants for horses in the U.S.
Pacelli says transport of horses to slaughter crammed into cattle cars or semi-tractor trailers without food or water is cruel. Plus, horses, unlike more docile cattle, are skittish and difficult to kill. Last count, in 1989, when slaughter was commonly practiced in the U.S., 348,000 horses were butchered, most of that meat exported. Horse meat is a staple in Central Asia and a culinary tradition among Parisians. But Americans, says Robert Lawrence, find eating horses abhorrent.
Horses are different because we don't eat them, because they are largely these days recreational vehicles. There are some that still work, but mostly we, you know, they're for our entertainment and amusement, and we ride them and we watch them being ridden and we gamble on them. But we don't eat them.
Robert Lawrence, a professor emeritus of law at the University of Arkansas, actually taught a course on equine law. Now retired, he and his wife keep horses. Several are thoroughbreds adopted from the racetrack industry, which he says breed as many as 10,000 animals a year, with only several thousand making the final cut to track. The rest, he says, are disposed of.
You know, they have very long lives and very short careers and very uncertain futures. So we do what we can.
Robert Lawrence offered to talk on the record for this story from a unique perspective.
Yeah, to me, it's not a humaneness issue. It's a business question. It has to do with the equine business in the United States and what it's all about. And what I suggest to people is that they pick up any horse magazine off the magazine rack and look at it, not the articles, but the advertisements. The image that is presented by them is entirely inconsistent with the idea of eating them.
Horses, he says, are American symbols, much like bald eagles. Americans don't wear pet pelts as apparel, and horses, for many, are pets.
And to me, that captures a good part of the whole slaughter debate. They're different. We like them.
But the debate around horse slaughter is not over, given that Oklahoma Senator Jim Inhofe and colleague Congressman Mark Wayne Mullen have vowed to introduce a standalone bill in Congress. But Humane Society of the United States Director Wayne Pacelli believes such a measure will fail.
You know, it'll be interesting to see what they come up with. There is a bill to ban horse slaughter, not just in the United States, but to ban live exports that has broad bipartisan support in Congress. That's been introduced by Mary Landrieu and Lindsey Graham from Louisiana and South Carolina. And there's a House bill that has more than 160 co-sponsors. So I'm not quite sure what the Oklahoma lawmakers are referring to. I'm not sure how they would even try to do it, because there's no national prohibition on slaughtering horses. There's just the defunding of USDA, and I'm not sure how they'd be able to orchestrate this.
Known as the Safeguard American Food Exports Act, a bipartisan measure sponsored by U.S. Senator Mary Landrieu of Louisiana and U.S. Representative Patrick Meehan of Pennsylvania. Language in the bill outlines human health risks associated with horse meat, which may contain numerous FDA-banned chemical substances. It is currently legal to transport horses out of the U.S. for butchering. According to USDA, 110,000 were shipped to Mexico and nearly 55,000 to Canada in 2012. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
You can hear great jazz right here on KUAF every Friday and Saturday night. Hello, I'm Robert Ginsberg, and my show, Shades of Jazz, can be heard Friday and Saturday nights from 10 till midnight. On Friday night, Daniel Estes steps in at midnight till 1 o'clock with Goodnight Jazz, and on Saturdays, it's Fred Hall taking in the midnight to 1 o'clock hour with Swing Thing. Tune in to KUAF for great jazz.
Just ahead on this edition of Ozarks, how the recent removal of trees along Don Tyson Parkway led to the creation of a tree farm on the east side of Springdale.
We have a lot of trees planted around town that are subject to damage from traffic from time to time. And when they get of a size, say a 3 or 4 inch diameter, when they get hit by a car, reacquiring a suitable tree of the correct species and size can sometimes be a lengthy endeavor. So our hope is to generate an inventory of trees at the tree farm.
That story coming up in about 14 minutes on Ozarks at Large.
But right now, we are going to continue our monthly Spaces series.
That's right. I'd say, 6 or 9 months ago, we came up with a Spaces series, taking our listeners into places where they traditionally can't go.
Mm-hmm. And you got to do a story on Sun's Chapel, a place you had driven by your whole life.
That's right.
I got to hang out backstage at the Walton Arts Center. And this month, I thought it would be fun to check out behind the scenes at a television station.
Right. I know Ozarks at Large is your source for radio news, but a lot of people probably tune in to some of our local television stations for other local news, KNWA being the NBC affiliate.
Yep. And last week I got to pay them a visit and they showed me around their station.
Ambush at Dark Canyon, with the proceeds going to Caring and Sharing of Northwest Arkansas. We caught up with him this afternoon in an interview you'll only see on KNWA.
In order for Neely Jones to anchor the 5 o'clock news at KNWA, work at the Fayetteville-based NBC affiliate must begin hours before the live broadcast starts. KNWA used to be located on the Fayetteville Square, where passersby could catch a glimpse of the studio through the glass storefront. In October of 2012, the station moved into its new home on the third floor of the Dixon in Fayetteville. Brooke Thomas is the news director at KNWA. A typical day for him begins between 8:30 and 9 a.m. Upon arriving, he touches base with the morning crew before the day shift starts to trickle in. Thomas's office is located on the north side of the newsroom. This room is comprised of one long row of desks and another shorter one positioned perpendicularly nearby. There are low partitions between each desk. The hum of police scanners can be heard coming from an elevated area in the corner of the room called the assignments desk.
740, King Charles Williams.
The open layout of the room is intentional, Thomas explains, because it allows everyone to communicate openly and easily, and it cuts down on a lot of communication barriers. At 9:45 a.m., the first of two editorial meetings begins inside a conference room located on the south side of the newsroom. One wall has been painted to be a dry erase board where ideas are jotted down. During this meeting, reporters pitch their ideas for stories, and once assignments are handed out, they go out into the field to conduct interviews. Thomas explains some days there is the obvious big story that needs to be covered. On days when there isn't that big story, one of the things they consider is their audience's interests. Staff members ask themselves, based on the audience watching the show airing prior to the newscast, what would they be most interested in hearing about? Reporters then try to tell the audience something related to that. For a television station, ratings are something to be considered. Every quarter, some viewers are asked to document what they watch and when in a ratings book. Once the data is analyzed, ratings are awarded, and that's what advertising sales are based on. Thomas says this is typically the way the revenue side of the business is done.
Fortunately, in the news department, we don't have to even deal with the revenue side of it, but the thing that we are tasked with is making sure that the product we're putting on the air generates a certain rating point in order to gain enough audience so that the sales side of it, the revenue side of it, can actually sell ads and we can keep the lights on. It is a business, and you know, we do have to try to make sure that we are gainfully employed. So that is part of it. But the other half of it is that, you know, we do employ a room full of professionals who actually care about what they're doing, and the idea that our product is going to be the best product that we can put on every single day is much more important to us, a lot more important to us. You know, we can worry about the revenue side all day long, but if we're not caring about the actual service that we're providing to our community, then I think we're hypocrites.
While the morning reporters are conducting interviews in the field, producers stay at the station and begin organizing content and writing scripts for the early evening shows. The night crew starts coming in around 1 in the afternoon, and a second editorial meeting occurs at 1:30. While a new batch of reporters heads out on assignments, the first set of reporters comes back and starts writing stories, and photographers begin editing video. John Cumston has been a photographer in the area for more than a decade. He says producing stories works best when there is a close collaboration between a reporter and a photographer.
The reporter should always feel like they can suggest shots to the photographer. Photographers should always feel like they could step in and ask a question in an interview or guide the story in a way that might not, you know, you might not think of just based on photography. So it's we try in our management here supports very much a very sort of egalitarian posture between reporter and photographer. We don't say my reporter, my photographer. We avoid language like that because we think it promotes teamwork.
If you walk down a hallway and through a pair of doors located to the west of the newsroom, you'll find yourself in the control room. There are several televisions located at the front of this room. In fact, with televisions in virtually every room in the building, news director Brooke Thomas estimates there are more than 40 televisions inside KNWA. Inside the control room, there are three approximately 60-inch television screens hanging side by side, and each one is equipped with multi-view. One monitor has 8 smaller screens on it, while the remaining 2 have 10 smaller screens on it. Those smaller screens show the station's different sources. For example, on one monitor, you may be able to see a shot of the main anchor at her desk, the chief meteorologist at his station, and another reporter who's standing outside. There is also a preview screen that allows the crew to view a shot prior to sending it out live over the air. Positioned above those 3 large televisions is a digital atomic clock, and above that are 8 smaller televisions. Thomas explains those show other TV stations so the staff can keep track of what's happening in the world, even while they're airing their own show. The control room has 3 tiers of desks arranged in stadium seating. The first and lowest desk, which is located at the front of the room, contains the director's board. The director sits at the right side of the desk and pushes buttons on this board to control what video is sent out over the air.
4, 3, 2, 1, roll rejoiner.
He is also in charge of launching commercials during breaks. The graphics operator is located to his left, and his area contains 6 different computer monitors. The director places images created by the graphics department over video, but he must organize this all prior to it being broadcast.
So as it's happening live, what you see at home, they've actually been building for the last 5-6 seconds. So they're having to constantly work ahead, which is where the producers writing the shows come into play, because they're scripting everything. So the directors are reading actual physical scripts and understanding what is coming next so that they can keep moving ahead and keep ahead of the show. They're not necessarily flying by the seat of their pants. It's all scripted.
The producer is positioned behind the director on a second tier. The producer has a rundown program on a computer where the script is located, and in addition to writing the script for the show, the producer is also in charge of making sure the show fits within the allotted amount of time. This means instructing on-air talent to talk longer or perhaps talk quicker if necessary. That communication can happen when reporters wear earpieces that allow them to hear a producer's instructions.
Neely, I'm going to cut down the Super Bowl script. And again, Dan has a quick 30 and 15.
The teleprompter is run by someone sitting to the left of the producer. It's their job to make sure the text is moving at the speed necessary for a reporter to read it. The audio station is located on the 3rd and final tier. While there are speakers located at the front of the control room, this tier has its own set of speakers, so the audio engineer can hear better and make sure the audio is clean. It also allows him to hear things that aren't on the air. For example, he can place a reporter preparing to speak in queue, which means only he can hear the reporter. This allows him to test the reporter's audio levels before sending his voice live over the air. Upon exiting the control room and walking through another set of doors, you'll find yourself in the news studio. The first set that greets you is the weather desk. A typical day for Chief Meteorologist Dan Scoff begins between 1:30 and 2 in the afternoon. He works until about 11 at night, but says sometimes he gets a break between shows where he can eat dinner with his family. The Weather Center has 9 computers, which Scoff says all have a different purpose. During severe weather, Scoff's day can start earlier and perhaps go later, depending on the weather system. He says he's there till it's over and has on occasion seen the sunrise. On a typical day, one of his tasks includes doing research and creating his own forecast. He says it can be a complicated process that can take more than 2 hours to calculate.
And if one little thing is off 4 or 5 days out when you're trying to forecast exactly how much it's going to snow on someone's house, if the system drifts, 30 miles farther north, your whole forecast changes. So it's complicated, but it's a challenge, and it's a challenge that I love, because it's just like I'm trying to beat the weather and figure out what's happening.
The Northwest Arkansas Weather Authority set is one of 4 sets located in the news studio. The other sets include the KNWA set and a green wall that's used for weather forecasts. The 4th set has a blue backdrop and is the set for the Fox News Edge, which airs on KNWA's sister station. News director Brooke Thomas explains the sets were built into the corners of the room to give depth and to fill the wide shots that come with filming in high definition. He says the new studio space is twice the size of their old location, but that's not even including the sports set, which is located in an adjacent room. The station as a whole has less space than their previous location, but Thomas says it feels like more space because they were able to design this space to fit their specific needs. The sets are on wheels, as are two cameras, which allows all of these items to be moved about the studio. The cameras are equipped with teleprompters so anchors can read their scripts, as well as a flat screen so they can see what's being shown on air. Walking through another set of doors, you'll find yourself in the sports studio. The studio has one large table and several workstations along the wall and one camera, although the other two cameras can be wheeled in from the new studio. The Razorback Nation staff consists of 5 members, and in addition to broadcasting in Northwest Arkansas, the team also does sports for a television station in Little Rock. The sports team also produces a 30-minute weekend show called The Pig Trail that airs around the state. Aaron Peters is the Razorback Nation anchor.
It's unique to any other place I've seen. The one thing about the job is they have us traveling all over to all sorts of different affiliates, so you really get a good perspective of what other sports departments do and how much effort they put into sports and the commitment level they put into sports, and ours is up there toward the top. I've been to San Francisco and Dallas and New York and Tampa, and none of them they treat sports quite like this because their view on it is that you can get what you need from ESPN or Fox or wherever, whereas here, Arkansas, you know, it's a finite brand of sports. You know, it's the Razorbacks, and a lot of times, especially if they're not doing well, they won't be on ESPN at all. So to get your fix on your Razorbacks, you got to turn to local sports.
After exiting the sports studio, you walk past the lobby, and as you circle back to the newsroom, you'll notice a break room tucked away behind a conference room. News director Brooke Thomas says they didn't have a break room in their previous location. However, the break room isn't always available, as it is now often the site where they film their newly launched cooking show called Cooking Today.
That's part of, I think, the environment that is bred here, which is, you know, we see a challenge and then we like to rise to it and say, okay, here's something we've never done before, so let's go out and just try to do it. And this is an example of something that we have literally never done. We have no idea what we don't know. We've just started, and here we go, and now I think we're going to learn a whole lot, and I think it'll be a success.
Local news airs at 5, 6, and 10 weeknights on KNWA and at 5:30 and 9 on Fox 24. For more information, you can visit nwahomepage.com. This is Ozarks at Large. It is Wednesday, January 22nd, 2014, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Thomas.
Joining us now is Becca Martin-Brown, Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Please tell me one of you speaks French.
No.
Sorry.
No.
I mean...
Well, we're going to take a run at how to say compagnie café. All right, here's what I know. Acrobats, dancers, boxers, 11 Brazilian men, a director from France, and Thursday night at the Walton Arts Center.
I'm going. I'm very excited.
It sounds really interesting. Hip-hop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Breakdancing and stuff?
The artists come from Rio de Janeiro and have grown up to do this hip-hop, samba, martial arts, circus arts.
It's a big mix.
Yeah, North African and Spanish roots, French dance tradition. It sounds fascinating.
It's interesting that it's all men. Because you don't really hear of a lot of dance troupes that are...
Well, it makes me think it's going to be loud and powerful and sort of like the drumming. Apparently, the second part of the show is like one suite. The first part is agua, which is water. And the second part is carreria. And they use water on the stage.
Oh, that's fun. It's been a long time, but I saw something... several years ago, Cirque de something. It was French, and there was the third act of that was rain. That was fun.
Or they just let the ice from Broadway on Ice melt. Never
mind. There you go. That seems like
That was a terrible pun. 8 o'clock Thursday, Walton Arts Center, $10. It's part of the 10 by 10 series. I'm going away now before this gets any worse.
Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Next time on NPR's Ask Me Another, our VIP Bon Appetit's editor-in-chief, Adam Rappaport, weighs in on one of his pet peeves, Yelp reviews.
I went to this place for my anniversary, and it was just like, they service. I was like, dude, what are you talking? Get a life.
Join me, Ophira Eisenberg, for a culinary journey on NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Tasty Trivia.
Listen to NPR's Ask Me Another, Saturdays at 11 a.m. on KUAF.
Last week, Springdale landscape crews removed over 100 trees along Don Tyson Parkway at the request of Johnny Tyson, who paid to replace them with all maple trees in an effort to have a more consistent flowering come spring and color in the fall. But what to do with the removed trees? The city of Springdale used this situational opportunity to launch a tree farm. I visited with some Springdale officials to find out that this is something they'd been thinking about for some time.
Now set your regulars, put your bucket down.
A crew of eight used a backhoe to replant the 105 lacebark elm, sycamore, and Chinese pistache trees on a portion of a 7-acre plot of land on the east side of Springdale.
We've always wanted to start a tree farm, but we're always looking for the right place.
That's Sam Goad, director of public works for the city of Springdale. He said the perfect location needed to be secure and have water available. This is something the city hadn't thought too much about until this unique opportunity to remove existing trees from Don Tyson Parkway came about, leaving them responsible for their roots. This tract of land is known as the McCalla site. The north side of the land is being used for one of two community gardens in Springdale. But the south side, or back end of this property, is an area well suited for the tree farm, and it was empty. Goad says a city-owned tree farm should prove to be both cost-effective and efficient.
We have a lot of trees planted around town that are subject to damage from traffic from time to time. And when they get a size, say a 3 or 4 inch diameter, when they get hit by a car, reacquiring a suitable tree of the correct species and size can sometimes be a lengthy endeavor. So our hope is to generate an inventory of trees at the tree farm to where Mike and his crew can go out, select a tree that they need, and transplant it from the tree farm to the location desired.
Mike Hickson is Springdale's landscape supervisor. He agrees that having trees in various sizes available to the city at any time will be less expensive than ordering full-grown trees from an outside company.
If you've got the ground to grow them in, you're going to save the city some money whenever they've got to have trees, because year after year they just continue to get larger, and then when you've got large trees available, you've got a situation where your investment in a small tree may have been $10 or maybe not even that much. When they get to be to a 2 to 4 inch caliber tree, you're looking at a cost of a tree when we order one out of a nursery or something like that, being anywhere from $125 to $250.
Hickson says that this is just one of the advantages. With the land already in place, a drip irrigation system will be installed. Once that is in place, very little time will be needed for maintenance of the trees, as watering will be done automatically. Once this is complete, in the next month or so, Hickson plans to acquire some very colorful and unique seedlings. Seedlings that are no more than 2 feet tall and skinny enough to resemble a whip.
A lot of different kinds of unique deciduous trees that have been imported from different places around the world, especially Asia, that grow in the same climates that we've got here, but they're just not native to this area. And so some of them are very decorative and very ornate. You know, you buy them as a very small seedling, and you plant it in a 1 gallon container, and then eventually begin to move it up as it grows, you know, over time. And so that's kind of something we're looking forward to, is doing a little experimenting with that as well.
Each spring for the last 6 years, Springdale has planted 400 to 600 seedlings as part of the Illinois River Watershed Partnership's riparian project. And Sam Goad sees many more trees being planted within the city's limits in the near future.
Another advantage of having a tree farm is the Razorback Greenway that's being constructed through Springdale, I believe our length through Springdale is approximately 9 miles. And along that trail will be trees that are planted for beautification. And those trees over time will need to be replaced for various reasons. So having the tree farm and with trees, as Mike has identified, unusual trees not native to this area, then we'll have an opportunity to plant along the trail either new or as replacement trees and get some unusual varieties for people to enjoy as they walk and bike along the trail.
Sam Goad is the Director of Public Works for the City of Springdale. Mike Hickson is the city's landscape supervisor. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Thomas.
Anna has certain things in common with the protagonist of her novel, A Step from Heaven. Like the character Young Joo, Anna was born in Korea and moved with her family to the United States when she was very young. The author does include some real memories in the novel, but most of the character's experiences are fiction. The book earned praise when it was published in 2001. It was awarded the Michael L. Prince Award as the best book written for teens, based entirely on literary merit. Anna will speak on the University of Arkansas campus tomorrow, and she talked to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums from her home in Vermont last week. Critics and reviewers have commended the characters in her book for speaking and thinking as a child without the text ever becoming condescending or too precocious. In A Step from Heaven, that meant writing for a character that ages from 4 to 18 in fewer than 200 pages.
Internally, I struggled a lot with trying to portray a young child's voice with all the kind of complex nuances that children have. And I think it's one of the things that, you know, we assume that kids have just simple grammar or simple ideas or whatever it is. But the way that I wanted to approach portraying Young Joo as a child was to try to really be in her eyes. And I remember reading Angela's Ashes and being blown away, just struck by how wonderfully he was able to capture that young boy's voice, or his young, you know, inner child's voice. And one of the things that I realized was part of the view of looking from within, you know, at that age, is that you often misunderstand things, or your impressions of people or ideas or things, they have their own kind of, I don't know, magical quality or spin to it. And so I really tried to see her world from her eyes. You know, even just imagining her height, you know, the way that if you're small and you have to look up at people, you know, what are the things that you notice? Or language, acquiring language, you know, what are the kinds of sounds and syllables? What does a foreign language sound like to a young child?
Well, it's really interesting because in A Step from Heaven, you have her at one point wondering about the word going. And her friends say, so-and-so is going with someone. But she can't quite figure out the context.
Right. And I actually, that happened to me as a preteen. And kids, at that point, you know, were speaking about dating. And I had no idea what that word was. And so that really does come from my own experience of trying to figure out different cultural kind of idioms. And it's, you know, speaking Korean at home and speaking English at the school, there were a lot of gaps in my understanding. And that's, again, part of, you know, portraying accurately that kind of childhood wonder. Well, there's also a cultural wonder. You know, what is that about, this word going? Or what do people eat on Thanksgiving besides Korean food?
Well, and even, you know, I think just part of being a child, and the adult world always seemed so mysterious to me. I remember hearing the term changing hands. A business was changing hands. And you're somewhat afraid to ask, or you think maybe you... And so there's this whole other world, this adult world that you don't quite get and you wonder about, and you capture that magnificently.
Oh, thank you. It's amazing what kids create. When they don't, I think that's part of the charm, is when they don't understand and they don't necessarily ask you, they will create an entire definition and meaning that they, you know, they believe is true. And it's really, it's quite striking. I find that one of the most magical parts of childhood.
Yeah, it's kind of like it's a crossword puzzle that you have to fill in, so you do the best you can.
Exactly.
With the life experience you have.
Right.
A Step from Heaven is, I don't know, in the copy I have is 170 or so pages. It takes place over about 14 years, and yet it never feels rushed. It never feels like there are gaps. You do it with such an economy of words. I would think that would be harder to create an entire sort of character than using many words.
The beauty of those vignettes, or the form itself, I struggled again trying to find the right form to tell this story, and I really do feel like the story took on the form that it needed to, because vignettes inherently leave space for readers to imagine, and it's a poetic form, so there's a sense of depth, you know, even in a short amount of time or space. And I also, you know, chose it very specifically because it felt like the way that my memories worked when I thought about growing up and immigrating from Korea to the United States. You know, we don't have our lives play out in an entire kind of, you know, one from beginning to end type of thing. What we do have are very episodic, very important, very visceral kinds of moments or smells or tastes or touch or, you know, some kind of visual. It's so I felt like the vignette form really captured the way that people remember their lives. And I wanted to be able to have readers not only identify with Young Ju, but also feel as though they were living her life in some way, you know, taking on that first person really deeply and moving through her memories, basically having those memories with her as she was growing up.
One thing that Young Ju is told before she goes to America and then shortly after is she can be anything she wants to be. And at one point she says maybe she'll be president, and she's laughed at. And it turns out they don't think you can be anything you want to be. So she finds out that being a girl is, and that's not the only time, but being a girl is different than being a boy.
Right, right, especially within her household. Yeah, it's definitely very clear cultural markers there. I mean, I think obviously there's gender inequality anywhere, but having grown up in a pretty patriarchal family and culture, it was something I was struck by when I was growing up. It was just known that, you know, sons were preferred in some ways. My parents would joke about having daughters and that they kept trying until they had a son. So it was just one of those things I felt always, you know. And I think the difference was made much more real because I was negotiating two cultures of being in the United States, but also feeling Korean when I was home. So having that marked difference of gender inequality was something that I really, not that I played that out, but I think it's just true to the culture, to the Korean culture at that time. I know a lot of it has changed, but I feel like there's still that kind of inherent understanding within Korean Americans and Koreans. Boys are definitely honored in a different way than women are.
You and Young Ju share a sort of basic history. It's inevitable that some people, when they know that, will think that this is an autobiography. How do you deal with that?
Oh, yes. That is a question that I get quite often. I deal with it by saying it is and it isn't. I think with any form of writing, even memoir or nonfiction writing memoir, there's a certain element of fiction that just creeps in. And so though I started from a place of wanting to capture some of the memories that I had, the book soon kind of diverged from my own upbringing and my own path to Young Ju's path and the character that she was in this book. And I tell people all the time she is a much braver, much wiser, much better person in so many ways, stronger, more noble. You know, the things that she struggled with in her family was so much greater, the adversities, compared to many of the things that I went through. I was well supported by my family. My father always believed, you know, I was going to go to college, even though I was a girl. It was just assumed, you know, we are all going to college. There was a great deal of support for my writing when I decided to get my master's. So there were so many people in my life, my family, my community, that supported me in a way that Youngju never got. I mean, it's just, it's one of those things that I think I was very fortunate, but I also know that there are many stories out there where children, young women, girls, all struggling to get to that dream, and they don't have the same kinds of support systems that I did. So it's a hard question, because often, you know, there are moments when you go into the book and you say, well, did that happen? And I can tell you, oh, yeah, that Coke thing, the bubbles in the nose, remember that so vividly.
I'm so glad you brought that up. I have that noted here, because it's the first time a child who has never been, whose taste buds, I take it, have never been anything close to Coca-Cola. And it's such a vivid memory. It's so well described.
Oh, it's clearly etched in my memory. The first time I had Coke, it was completely baffling that anybody would want to drink this acid biting drink. And of course, you know, you burp and it goes right into your nose. And I just remembered tearing up, like, what is this? Yeah, up until that point, I had drank tea and water and milk, and that was about it. So carbonated drinks were something I avoided for a long time.
Well, and there was this thing that happens when you're a child, that happens when you're describing it. It's not pleasurable. And then one of the adults says, you know, go ahead and drink that, and you can have some more.
Mm-hmm.
The last thing you're thinking is, I don't want any more.
Right. Very different perspectives from adults and childhood.
Of course, Youngju is born in Korea, comes to the United States, feels cultural differences. So every person who reads this is not reading it in the same way. But there is that universal sort of theme of otherness, of being secluded or not part of a group. And that speaks in this book. You don't have to be male, female, young. I think you get to the heart of that over and over.
I think alienation, shame, difference, all those themes that children, young people struggle with, feeling alone compared to their peers, you know, family life versus school or, you know, outside exterior life, those are all themes that I think a lot of children resonate with. And I definitely, in school visits and talks, have found that children really gravitate to the ideas because they have felt them, whether they're immigrants or not. They understand. You know, they might have felt ashamed of their parents at one point, or ashamed of some situation, or alone with their thoughts, you know, when everybody else was doing something else. And I think those are obviously childhood themes that anyone can relate to.
There's a vignette where Youngju has convinced her mother to spend a dollar on a lottery ticket. And she's convinced, pretty convinced, that there's a real good chance that their family will win the $23 million. And she counts down the clock. She can barely finish her dinner. And then she comes out and watches the television. And in a flash, the numbers are red. She only has one of the proper ones. And there is this sentence. She has this realization that a dollar for afternoon dreams is expensive and cheap. That is a wonderful sentence, and without over-romanticizing, without too many words, you've summed up one of those realizations you have when you're going from childhood to adulthood. It's beautiful.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I definitely played the lottery and still play every once in a while for fun. And I do. It is really a moment for me to dream and to play. And my daughters and I, you know, get together and we pick out the numbers and we laugh and we talk about, well, what would you do? And it's one of those things that it's bittersweet that way, especially for Youngju. I see the more of the kind of playfulness of it now, but back then, and especially Youngju in her situation, it's so bittersweet. And that was the first vignette where I really started to understand what the story, how this story would shape up. So that's one of my favorite vignettes that I often read, and and that I come back to over and over again.
I would imagine many of your readers are younger than you and I are.
Mm-hmm.
And when you were writing Step from Heaven, there are a couple of times when she and her brother reference cartoons or television shows that were on when I was young, when you were young.
Oh, you remember. That's wonderful.
You know, Wonder Twins activate.
Yes.
You just throw that in. And I'm curious, are you ever concerned that maybe a current 13 or 12-year-old may have no idea what that means?
You know, so here's the trick about writing so you don't necessarily date yourself. You don't give too many examples. Like, you try to avoid words like iPod. I mean, nowadays it's just so, you know, it's ubiquitous. But in 10 years, it might not be the iPod. It might be,
right,
you know, something else. And so we try to, you know, we encourage, when I'm teaching writing, I talk about generalizing, you know, music player, whatever it is. Like, give it something a little bit generic or maybe a little bit different. Just spin the words a little bit. But some things like Wonder Twin Powers, you know, these are TV references that I know nobody except a certain generation of us will understand, but it still has that same resonance. Like, it's a cartoon, and this idea of Wonder Twins, you know, that could be now. It could be, you know, 20 years from now, 20 years past, you know, whatever it is. I think it felt, at least when I was going through and revising and looking at all those kind of very specific cultural or generational markers, it felt, you know, generic enough, but at the time specific enough to just kind of throw in there.
What will you talk about when you're in Fayetteville at the University of Arkansas?
So I'm going to be talking about, the title of my talk is called The Power of One Voice. And it comes from this idea of, you know, obviously it's going to be Martin Luther King's birthday on Monday. And I wanted to just to touch upon a couple different kind of political issues that are running through my mind right now, but also historical issues and also personal, you know, personal power in terms of having the ability to affect change.
An Na is the author of several books, including A Step from Heaven, Wait for Me, and The Fold. She'll speak on the University of Arkansas campus tomorrow evening at 7 inside Giffel's Auditorium in Old Main. The talk, sponsored by the College of Education and Health Professions and the Brown Chair in English Literacy, is free and open to the public. She spoke with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums last week.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, hospital diplomacy. A family in Iran sees their brain-dead daughter cared for by nurses in Michigan thanks to the Internet.
And they were so comfortable that they actually asked the nurses to stroke her hair, to kiss her forehead, and provide that loving touch that they normally would.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Stay tuned to KUAF. Here and Now begins next after Ozarks at Large.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Wheeler.
Just a couple of things to note. There's a reception this evening from 6 p.m. until 7:30 for an exhibit at the Ann Kittrell Art Gallery on the University of Arkansas campus. It shows the work of an interdisciplinary course with students from mathematics, computer science, architecture, and philosophy. Most of the time, in using a manufacturing machine, the goal is to control the object the machine outputs. Yet, this requires indirect control of the machine through proprietary software. Thinking instead about the line, designers describe the path the machine will take. For this exhibition, students explore different ways in which lines can be registered on a computer and then manipulated. The exhibit runs through February 14th. More information at art.uark.edu.
And there's a few chances to see area collegiate sports this week. JBU men's and women's basketball teams will host Men America Christian tomorrow night in Siloam Springs. Women's games at 6, men's games at 8. And the basketball teams at University of Arkansas Fort Smith will host McMurray tomorrow night at 5:30 and 7:30. And speaking of men's basketball, the Razorbacks have the opportunity to tie an odd NCAA record tonight when they play Tennessee. They've played three consecutive overtime games, and the NCAA record is 4 straight. So we'll find out how that goes tonight.
We will.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. We'll end today with some music by local band Goose, who will have a free show tomorrow night at Georgia's Majestic Lounge. You can find out more at facebook.com/bandgoose. Thanks again for listening, and have a great Wednesday.